We're sticking with the topic of the virus now with our next guest. Dr. Jeremy Faust is Brigham and Women's Hospital emergency medicine physician and Bulletin.com writer of Insider Medicine. Dr. Faust, thank you so much for joining us today. The Wall Street Journal reported earlier today that hospital beds are being cut across many hospitals across the nation, given both the increase in COVID cases due to Omicron and staffing shortages. You've also written about concerns about hospitals overflowing. What are you seeing right now in terms of the strain that hospitals are under during this latest surge in cases?
Thanks for having me. What we're seeing across the nation is a combination of non-COVID care and COVID care, bringing hospitals to the brink of trouble where they can't provide the care they would like to provide, need to provide patients. So you look at a place like Maryland, which I wrote about, and the federal data would suggest that there's some wiggle room. But on the ground and on the dashboard tracker that my team has made, we see a very different picture, which is that there are essentially crisis standards of care in certain parts of the country. So we are now facing a real key moment in this pandemic, in my belief, which is a situation in which we could confront the circumstance in which not every patient has what they need. We really haven't had that happen very often. We haven't had those catastrophic pictures like you saw in Italy. But the combination of existing care for non-COVID and Omicron is taking some areas to that brink and over, I fear. And that's a real tragedy because it is preventable.
Dr. Faust, good to see you. In fact, I'm looking at your article right now that posted today in which you quote another doctor from Johns Hopkins talking about the highest number of hospitalizations in the state in our health system ever. Several hospitals have moved to crisis standards of care. So for those of us who don't know the medical world, I mean, we hear those horror stories. There was an individual in the Midwest, had sepsis, could not get into a hospital bed for a month, and then died. Is that where we are in your state? Is that the kind of scenario we're facing?
I haven't faced that. I think that I'm fortunate to work in an area that has a lot of resources, but I don't think anyone's immune to that. I think it's just a matter of numbers and whether or not each community is able to control this. So there's different levels of risk. If you have a hospital that's where the ICU is over 75, 80, 90% capacity, even before you reach 100% capacity, we know from medical research and lots of years of data that even getting close to capacity can cause a small increase in all-cause mortality because it's just stretching the system. What happens when you get over 100%? It really depends on what the patients are needing from us. If it's all very mild but important care, that's we can kind of piece it together. But if it's a lot of very sick patients at once, then you can have these horror stories. And we want them to be these isolated events, but I'm worried that it won't be isolated in some areas.
Going back to your earlier response, you mentioned that this tragedy is preventable in terms of the state that hospitals are in right now. What do you think needs to be done to alleviate some of the strain on the healthcare system?
Right now, we see that about 7 or 8 states in this country are expected to exceed hospital capacity in the next 7 days unless they change what they're doing. They do less elective care, for example. So that's one thing. We need to see only the care that's absolutely necessary right now being done. This is not a time for hospitals to worry about their profit margins. We need them to worry about the sickest patients coming through the door. We also see that the number of healthcare workers is always in flux because of a number of infections. It's preventable because we actually give this real-time data to counties if they want it, and they can say, wait a sec, next week is going to be worse than this week. We should really anticipate that. So it's preventable in the sense that we're never going to get rid of coronavirus spread with what I call a circuit breaker, which is to increase hospital capacity or to decrease elective care, and even things in the public like temporary decreasing large gatherings, indoor dining a little bit. Just small changes can make a big difference on the margins. So that's what I'm asking people to do because it's preventable in terms of keeping the hospital safe, not preventable in terms of getting, you know, coronavirus spreading all over this country. That the cat's out of the bag. But in terms of keeping the hospital safe, just a little bit of collective action for a short period of time, a circuit breaker, can make a real difference and save lives.
I think a lot of us are looking to the day when people like you and all of the people at the hospitals get some much deserved and much needed rest. When we hear about these different variants that may or not be discovered, I mean, there's the one where Delta and Omicron may have merged. We don't know the truth about this, but the way viruses progress, do they naturally weaken over time simply because if you kill your host, you yourself are going to die. Therefore, you need to be a weaker version of the contaminant?
That's a great question. And evolution favors a more contagious virus for sure, because if it's more contagious, it just outcompetes. So that's certainly something that evolution does favor, is more contagion. In terms of milder disease, that's definitely true at the extremes. We can all kind of do the thought experiment of if there was some disease that killed its recipient on contact and then was not could not be spread from the dead body of that person, this virus would not last very long. It couldn't spread. But with Omicron and Delta, all of these pathogens are well within the interquartile range or mid-range, where it's certainly contagious and causes disease. There's no real selective pressure, evolutionary pressure, to make it milder over time, unless you're at that extreme. A very, very deadly pathogen that can't be spread doesn't last. We never notice that. So yes, more contagiousness happens over time. It's not guaranteed that it will become more mild over time, but it's not an advantage or a disadvantage per se. Look, the most interesting of these viruses are things like Ebola, which you can walk around with for days and not infect your family. And then patients show up at the ICU, and despite PPE, they're so contagious that the nurses get it and the patient dies. So all these parameters are in play. Every virus is different, and we need to respond accordingly.
In terms of the policy response, the first stages of the Biden administration's COVID vaccine or regular testing mandate began today, though some of these elements are still under consideration by the Supreme Court. Now, some states have already said that they will not be enforcing these mandates, but assuming these rules were applied and enforced nationwide, how much of an impact would this have on bringing down infections?
Well, it remains to be seen about infections. I believe that the vaccines slow down infection, boosters slow down infection, and certainly I think we've seen transmission from there. So if you're infected while having been vaccinated, you are spreading for less amount of time. We certainly saw that with the previous variants, and I expect we'll see something similar with Omicron. I don't know the exact numbers. The question is, do the mandates work? How do they go out in terms of rollout? I tend to think of mandates is a little bit less dramatic than some people do. We all want to focus on the people who are, you know, kicking and screaming and making a scene. And in reality, mandates really do two things. It's a nudge for people who are thinking about doing it and wanted to do it, gives them a deadline. And that's clearly, there's evidence that that happens. When states make it so exemptions are harder to get for, you know, seasonal vaccines like flu, then vaccine rates just go up and no one ever makes any complaint about it. So that's a nudge. And then the other part is the opposite. This is sludge, right? This is what my colleague Cass Sunstein always talks about, nudge and sludge. Sludge is, well, I want to go to this event, but a vaccine's required, so I better go get vaccinated. So I think that for most of these purposes, mandates are really about nudging people in the right direction. Yeah, there's a few cases where it's sort of cornering someone who didn't want to do it, and that makes headlines. But I think that's a minority of really what this is about, and that's why I think they're effective. So I'm in favor of them, but I think that sometimes it takes up more oxygen than is necessary.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Dr. Jeremy Faust, Brigham and Women's Hospital emergency medicine physician and Bulletin.com writer of Insider Medicine, thank you so much for your time.